Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Professor Kalila Brown-Dean, one of three co-authors of a new report titled 50 Years of the Voting Rights Act, who assesses racial polarization in U.S. electoral politics and recent voter suppression tactics. Mika Utrecht of In These Times magazine, who talks about why Chicago's progressive movement has rallied to support Jesus Chuy Garcia to defeat incumbent mayor Rahm Emanuel. And Anya Rudiger of the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, who discusses a proposed new financing plan to fund a universal single-payer healthcare system in the state of Vermont. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new Human Rights Watch report documents how top security officials under former President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan oversaw murders, abductions, and other human rights violations. The report details the abuses of eight politically connected Afghan commanders, including the powerful police chief of Kandahar province, Brigadier General Abdul Razik, who has been implicated in ordering extrajudicial executions. Since 2011, the United Nations has documented the systemic use of torture in Kandahar by both police and intelligence units. Human Rights Watch is pressing newly elected Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to bring recent human rights abusers to justice. Already, President Ghani has launched an initiative to eliminate torture carried out by the country's security forces. Human Rights Watch's Faleem Khan declared, "The previous Afghan government and the United States enabled powerful and abusive individuals and their forces to commit atrocities for too long without being held to account." The Guardian newspaper reports that the family of a Chechen man, Ibrahim Todashev, who was shot 7 times by an FBI agent during a 2013 interrogation, is suing the FBI for $30 million in a wrongful death suit. The state chapter of the Council of Muslim American Relations filed papers in Florida on behalf of Todashev's family, accusing the FBI and Special Agent Aaron McFarlane of many missteps, including negligence, that led to this illegal killing. Todashev, a friend of accused Boston bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was being questioned about his relationship with Tsarnaev and a 2011 murder in Massachusetts. A 2014 report by the Florida Attorney General concluded the Chechen national lunged at the FBI agent near the end of a 5-hour interrogation. Lawyers for Todashev say he was recovering from knee surgery during the interrogation and could not walk. McFarlane, the FBI agent who shot the Chechen, faced several brutality lawsuits when he was a police officer in Oakland, California. Georgetown University graduate Clara Gustafson surprised a lot of her friends when she moved to gritty downtown Baltimore to take a prestigious fellowship at Venture for America, which matches millennials with new tech companies in cities like Detroit, Cincinnati, and Providence, Rhode Island. A growing number of young, educated millennials are moving to older cities where the cost of living is more affordable than Seattle, Boston, or New York City. In Cleveland, 20-somethings are snapping up downtown apartments, and over the last decade, St. Louis has doubled its ranks of young professionals. While the trend of young millennials migrating to less glamorous urban centers has captured headlines, a third of all young adults in the U.S. live at home with their parents and suffer from high rates of unemployment. Joe Courtwright, an urban economist, observes that increasing poverty still plagues many of America's distressed cities, where school systems are struggling and joblessness is often far higher than the national average. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On the weekend of March 7th and 8th, tens of thousands of people from across the U.S. and the world gathered in Selma, Alabama, to commemorate the 1965 Civil Rights March known as Bloody Sunday, where 600 peaceful demonstrators demanding the right to vote were attacked by Alabama state troopers and county posses. The police assault resulted in 17 injured protesters being sent to the hospital, and worldwide attention focused on America's civil rights struggle. 5 months later, in August 1965, Congress passed and President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act that provided for federal oversight of local election laws. Veterans of the civil rights struggle joined elected officials in Selma, including America's first black president, Barack Obama. In an address made on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the president recognized the progress made in civil rights since 1965, but acknowledged that racism still casts a dark shadow on the nation. One major reversal for the Voting Rights Act, frequently cited in Selma, came in a 2013 Supreme Court ruling, which gutted a key section of the legislation that provided a coverage formula identifying jurisdictions requiring pre-clearance. Since then, Republican-controlled states have passed a flood of new restrictive voting laws that disproportionately suppress the votes of minorities, the elderly, and young people. Your reporter spoke with Kalila Brown Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and one of three co-authors of a new report published by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies titled 50 Years of the Voting Rights Act, The State of Race in Politics. Here, Professor Brown Dean assesses the racial polarization in U.S. electoral politics, recent voter suppression tactics, and congressional action necessary to restore the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
So what we found is that since 1965, we've seen a dramatic increase in registration and voter turnout, not just among African Americans, as the act originally targeted, but also increasingly language minorities like Latinos and Asian Americans. All of those communities have increased their profiles as voters, as elected officials. So in 1965, there were less than 1,000 black elected officials. Now they're well over 10,000. And so that is tremendous progress. But what we also have found is that elections in this country have become more racially polarized than ever before, particularly at the local election. So that as African Americans moved into the voting process, moved into the political arena, whites often retreated from the Democratic Party. And so one of the questions that we ask is, what is the consequence of that? Now that in local elections, what we find with the data is that race is the most decisive factor for determining the outcome of those elections, not party, not class, not ideology, but racial identification.
And just for some background there, I know when you look at history, President Johnson, when he signed the civil rights initiatives in the mid-1960s, he acknowledged that the solid South for the Democratic Party was going to be gone quite soon because of racial prejudice that existed among whites in many of those states. And his forecast came true. Many of those Democratic representatives in Congress and the Senate switched parties, moved to the Republican Party. And a lot of the states' populace followed in terms of their turnout for elections in latter days. Maybe you could talk about the Southern strategy and how that plays into the findings in this report.
Right. So one of the things that is really interesting in terms of the data is looking at the sort of traditional gaps in participation across the South. So that in 1965, sort of the heels of the Bloody Sunday March, African Americans were only participating at about 4%. So 4% of African Americans were actually able to maneuver that process and go out and vote. And so not only did you keep racial groups separate and sort of manipulate access to the ballot box, it also allowed the Democratic Party to have a stronghold regionally, but to also think about the national profile. And so Johnson was really concerned, what will this mean for the party? Even if we can agree that obstructing access to the ballot box based on race is not in America's best interest, politically and strategically, what will this mean? And so now what we see is that in those former states of the Confederacy, African American turnout in presidential elections often exceeds that of white voters. And so that's a remarkable trend to think about what that has meant in terms of historically. But blacks continue to be underrepresented in elected office. So blacks make up about 13% of the total U.S. population, but are less than 10% of members of Congress. Latinos have made inroads into Congress, still underrepresented. Asian Americans, the most underrepresented.
one of the very important issues, not directly addressed in this report, but certainly critically related to a lot of your findings, is the recent campaign by mostly Republican state legislatures and governors to impose restrictive voting ID requirements, curtailing early voting hours, putting new obstacles in place for registering new voters. And disproportionately, many studies I've read say that this affects minority populations, the elderly, and the young, like college students.
Right.
Address that for us and tell us, maybe scan what you see as the problem here and how to address it.
So the report itself does not address the structural constraints. We want to see sort of empirically what those trends are. But we do know that those structural constraints have created real barriers, particularly for the groups that you mentioned, for older Americans, for minorities, for young people like college students. And we see that happening regionally. So a lot of those measures being adopted in the South hours after the Supreme Court reached its decision in 2013, gutting Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. And so what we're looking at now and sort of monitoring is, what will this mean in the long run? I think one of the things that we tend to do in the United States is only focus on presidential elections. We get a lot of energy behind those national races. But as I said before, it's really at the local level where we see these things having a direct impact, decreasing the number of people who are eligible to vote, and often disrupting that sense of civic engagement that people feel. Having access to the ballot is fundamental to American democracy. It is what we think separates us from other countries. And so if we can agree that that is the essence of our democracy, then we have to come together across the political aisle. So there was a lot of strategizing this weekend about ways to do that, but still being realistic that given the current composition of this Congress, it will be a very difficult battle. But it is one that people like Representative John Lewis believes that we need to address succinctly.
That was Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and one of three co-authors of a new report titled 50 Years of the Voting Rights Act, The State of Race and Politics. Find more analysis of voting rights and suppression tactics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The surprisingly strong showing of Cook County Commissioner Jesus Chuy Garcia in the Chicago mayoral election February 24th deprived incumbent Democratic Mayor Rahm Emanuel of an outright victory and forced him into a runoff on April 7th. Garcia entered the race late after Chicago Federation of Teachers President Karen Lewis had to drop out due to illness. In the first round of the election, Democrat Garcia had very little campaign funds compared to Emanuel's large war chest, who some call Mayor 1%, charging that he supports the agenda of the city's elite and focuses on downtown development while neglecting the neighborhoods. Garcia won 34% of the vote compared to Emanuel's 45%. Garcia has a long history of progressive activism in Chicago and was an ally of Harold Washington, the city's first black mayor, who served from 1983 until he died in office in 1987. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mika Utrecht, web editor with Chicago-based In These Times magazine and author of Strike for America, a book about the historic 2012 Chicago teacher strike. He says Garcia's strong showing was a surprise to just about everyone, but now money is flowing into his runoff election campaign from unions and national groups such as Democracy for America and attracting campaign volunteers from the American Federation of Teachers. Many Chicagoans now believe that in the April 7th election, they can make Rahm Emanuel a one-term mayor.
People have talked about this race sort of like they talked about Bill de Blasio's win for mayor in New York City, or maybe the fight within the Democratic Party about whether we'll have Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren running for president as the sort of fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. And there's a sizable and growing number of people who are opting for a much more progressive wing of the party. And that's certainly true. But the bigger story is it's not just that people are opting for this more progressive version, but that social movements in the city, like the Chicago Teachers Union and this movement that they've helped anchor around educational justice in the city, the neighborhood level community groups in the city, they are the ones who made this runoff happen over the course, organizing very deeply over the course of several years. I mean, this runoff would have never happened if the Chicago Teachers Union hadn't gone on strike in 2012, for example. That's really a pivotal moment in the city. People moved from being sort of incoherently angry about some of these policies like school closures and defunding of public schools and closing of mental health clinics and all these things. They moved from being incoherently angry about those things into having a clear enemy, being able to say, Rahm Emanuel is responsible for these closures and these defunding and all these things, and he needs to go.
Micah Utrecht, I just read an article that said some independent body found that 90% of the kids whose schools were closed ended up in better schools, even though some were only very marginally better, that he made a tough decision that was better for those students. What do you think of that?
Well, I think to answer that question, it's useful to look at the data about what happened in the election in those areas where schools were closed. Wet Moser, who writes for Chicago Magazine, had an interesting blog post where he compared the voting data. He overlaid where the school closures in the city happened over the voting data about who voted for Rahm versus Chewy or other candidates. And he found pretty much across the board that in the areas that were immediately surrounding these 49 schools that were closed, that those, and assumedly these are voters whose kids were attending these schools that were closed, Rahm Emanuel lost votes almost across the board in the immediate surrounding areas of these schools. And so if the school closures have produced better results for people's children, I would assume that the parents would be, you know, showing their gratitude for Rahm Emanuel by voting for him. But instead, you know, the closures and the other educational cuts that have happened in the city became a central issue of the mayoral race. I should also mention that one of the measures that was on the ballot, in addition to who was going to be mayor in Chicago, in almost 40 wards, the question of whether the city should have an elected representative school board, that is, a school board that's chosen by the people of Chicago. And overwhelmingly, by 89% voters, it was a non-binding referendum, so they just were indicating that, yes, they do want an elected representative school board. 89% said, yes, that's what we want. And the reason they want that, and the reason that the Chicago Teachers Union and other organizations in the city have pushed for this, is because the school closures happened despite community groups, you know, moving heaven and earth to try to stop them from happening, from a near unanimous participation in public meetings saying we don't want these closures to happen. These are really pillars of our communities. And they were all closed anyway. 49 of them were closed anyway.
What about going forward? What do you see happening over the next year or so?
The big story in Chicago is this election between Rahm Emanuel and Chewy Garcia. And obviously that is the most important thing that's happening in our runoff election. But a story that's flying under the radar is this different way that these elections have been done, both at the mayoral level and at the city council level. Chewy Garcia is very open about the fact that he only ran for mayor because he was asked to by Karen Lewis, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union. He all but admits that he wouldn't be even a candidate if it wasn't for the city's social movements pushing him to do it. And likewise, at the city council level, the races were extremely interesting in that it was not just a number of progressive candidates who, you know, sprung up and were trying to seize the momentum from, you know, a mayoral ally, a right-wing city council member. What set this election apart was that there were grassroots activists, rank-and-file teachers, community organizers, or community activists who actually ran for city council seats and, in a number of cases, forced runoffs. In addition to all of the city's progressive caucus, which is extremely small, about half a dozen people out of the 50 city council members who are on the caucus, almost all of them won re-election. But a number of these political nobodies who are, you know, like I said, high school teachers or teachers' aides ran and actually forced runoffs. And so I think it'll be interesting to watch what happens in Chicago over the next couple of years and if there's a continued growth of this kind of bottom-up politics where you have rank-and-file teachers running for office.
That was Micah Utrecht, web editor with In These Times magazine. For more information on progressive groups active in the Chicago mayoral campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In May 2011, Vermont's legislature approved and Democratic Governor Shumlin signed Act 48, a bill which requires the state to establish a universal health care system by 2017. Governor Shumlin described the plan, known as Green Mountain Care, as a single-payer system that he believed would control health care costs not just by cutting fees to doctors and hospitals, but by fundamentally changing the state's health care system. Although studies had been conducted on how best to design and implement Vermont's new universal health care plan, in December 2014, Governor Shumlin announced that with an estimated $3 billion annual cost by the end of the decade, now was not the right time to go forward, and he put Green Mountain Care on hold. Many supporters of the universal health care plan were angry, with some burning their medical bills at the state capitol in Montpelier and delivering a plate of burnt toast to Shumlin's office, suggesting that the governor's political career had been irreparably damaged. In an effort to overcome this setback, a plan has now been developed to revive Green Mountain Care. The Vermont Workers Center and the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, or NESRI, have recently published a study that they say lays out a concrete financing plan to affordably establish universal health care in Vermont by 2017. Your reporter spoke with Anya Rudiger, director of programs with NESRI and one of the authors of the plan, who talks about their equitable financing proposal that has already been endorsed by over 100 economists.
This effort was really unique and very pioneering. There's been no other state that has attempted to really move to a universal publicly financed healthcare system. So it's understandable that the governor took a long time to reflect about financing. He missed a deadline to submit a financing plan by about 2 years. It was a pretty heavy lift. But the way he designed his proposal was basically to place the same burden on all companies. So he proposed a flat payroll tax of 11.5%, and every company, whether we're talking about a national company that's doing business in Vermont or your mom-and-pop shop, would have to pay the same 11.5%. And when we saw that in his proposal, we were like, yeah, that's not going to work. And why are you proposing something like that? You got to charge everybody based on their ability to pay. So when we saw that the governor came out with a financing plan that was doomed to failure because of his flat taxes, we thought, well, really, let's just demonstrate that we can show that universal health care not only is feasible in Vermont, but also can be financed a lot more equitably through progressive taxation, that it can rein in the overall cost of health care, and that it can guarantee much, much improved health care access to all Vermont residents. And that's what our plan set out to do, and we used Governor Shumlin's modeling data as a baseline. So we basically used a lot of his information to just tweak those features that we felt were done in an unfortunate and inequitable way in his plan. And instead, we changed the income tax to be much more based on people's ability to pay. We removed the cap for high earners so that the top 1% actually have to pay their fair share, which they did not in Governor Shumlin's plan. And we designed a new payroll tax model that is quite unique, actually, in that we took into account not just business size, so that smaller businesses pay less than larger businesses, but also the wage gap that businesses have between what they pay their employees. So we were able to combine that and thus come out with a tax rate that in our model showed that small businesses would very much be able to afford universal health care, as would large businesses, because they currently pay a lot toward their employees' insurance premiums. They actually pay 80% of insurance premiums right now. So the payroll tax just would replace that current contribution.
Anya, I wanted to ask you, how much support is there in the state legislature for this alternative financing plan for universal health care in Vermont than the governor's original plan, which he suspended, took off the table?
The governor is pretty powerful, as is the legislative leadership. And, you know, we're currently witnessing the regular routine of party politics. So I think we have to put a lot of pressure onto the legislature to make them realize that there really is a solution to the current problem of the income gap and wealth gap that we experience in Vermont and in other states. It's just that legislators have a hard time actually making that link. They feel like, well, maybe access to healthcare is getting better. Well, it's really hard for people who may be insured but who face deductibles and copays. And legislators don't understand the link between the way we pay for healthcare and how that undermines all the other public services we can or cannot afford to provide, and how that is linked to income inequality that we're currently experiencing. If low-income people pay so much more per head for their health care than wealthy people, that is a huge part of our current income and wealth gap that legislators really do have to address.
Anya, I wanted to ask you about the importance of what you're doing there in Vermont in terms of creating a viable model for universal health care. How important is that for the rest of the country in terms of moving the nation towards single payer? As I understand it, in Canada, the first universal health care single payer system developed in Saskatchewan originally, and then the success there spawned the adoption of the plan nationally by the Canadian federal government. So how does that relate to the situation in the U.S., you think?
Well, that's exactly our plan, Scott. So that is what we're looking at as a model. We think that Vermont is a great state to start in. It's a small state, and we feel the Healthcare as a Human Right campaign has made a tremendous difference there in getting the first universal publicly financed healthcare system passed into law. So we think that Vermont could be an example. It could, in fact, be the first domino that could fall and lead to an effect of a domino effect of state-level healthcare wins that could then potentially result in a critical mass of states pushing the federal debate and the federal policy process, and then ultimately result in national publicly financed health care.
That was Anya Rudiger, Director of Programs with the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. Learn more about Vermont's effort to establish a single-payer health care system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.